This is episode number 81 with a data visualization designer, Nadi Bremer.
Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. My name is Kirill Eremenko, data science coach and lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you inspiring people and ideas to help you build your successful career in data science. Thanks for being here today, and now let's make the complex simple.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Super Data Science Podcast. I've got a very, very exciting guest on the show. Nadi Bremer is a person who I've been a fan of for a long time. She is the creator of the website visualcinnamon.com. If you haven't seen it, you have to see it. It's got some of the most beautiful visualizations there. And before we continue, I wanted to quickly say that this podcast is one of those rare podcasts where it's also available in a video. So if you are around your computer, then I suggest you check it out. Check out the video recording for this podcast at www.superdatascience.com/81. And there you'll see Nadi, and you'll get inspired by her, and you'll see how we're talking about all of these things, the same things as in the podcast, exactly the same audio, but with video. At the same time, if you're listening in your car or on a run or a jog, totally understand. That's totally cool. Keep listening. You'll get exactly the same insights, and then maybe someday you can check out the video as well, or just have a look at parts of our conversations there. And so, but back to the podcast, what are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about visualization, how visualization is super important in today's world, how it tells stories in data science, and what tips and hacks you can apply to your data visualization. So stay tuned. You will get lots of tips and insights. You'll also get some insights on freelance work and shifting careers. It's a very exciting podcast. Can't wait for you to check it out. And without further ado, I bring to you Nadi Bremer, a freelancing data visualization designer. Welcome, everybody, to the Super Data Science Podcast. Got a very exciting guest of whom I've been a long-term fan, Nadi Bremer, on the show. Nadi, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So where are you calling in from?
I'm calling in from a really tiny town outside of Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
Okay, wow. So it's I've been to Amsterdam, and as we discussed, like you have a lot of pigeons in that city. Do you have a lot in your little town as well?
No. Our town is in the green, so I look out and I see cows and horses and sheep, but okay. I hardly ever see pigeons, which I'm thankful for.
Okay, so cool. But yeah, thanks for coming on the show. And for those, probably nobody knows the story except for me and Nadi, because I've just told her about it, that first time I encountered her work was when I was looking for a self-organizing map implementation in an open source software, and you have a fantastic implementation in R. Which you showcase on your website. Unfortunately, you couldn't share the code because it was while you were working at Deloitte in the Netherlands. But nevertheless, that was very inspiring to me, and since I followed your work. And so tell us, what exactly is it that you do?
I visualize data. So I make insights become visible to people in a way that's like converting numbers to actual visual encodings. And I do that either to inform people, it's always to inform people, but I also try to make it visually engaging so that you're also drawn into it and want to investigate actually the insights that can be found.
Okay, that's really cool. And like, I would probably take it to the next level. You come up with very innovative and creative ways. Like, I had a look at your website and just some of your recent ones, like the one you did for Google Labs, or the one on the butterflies. What is it called? The marble butterflies?
Yeah, exactly.
It looks fantastic. Like, is that? It doesn't even look like real data. Is that real data used for the marble butterflies?
It's real data. I manually gathered data on butterfly species and colors and wingspans, and that is what's guiding this visualization of marble butterflies. This underlying data set of about 90 different butterfly species.
Wow! And how does the visualization move across like the canvas? Is it like random movement?
It is random, yeah. So the idea is that every butterfly, sort of every animation frame in the browser, a butterfly is created and then sort of flitters across the screen. And that is sort of randomly generated which way they are going to go. So the color, the size, and the look of the path is defined by data. But then the actual path across the screen is more just random. And if it's at some point it tries to go up, and at some point it might go into a turn or a different turn. And then lots of those butterflies over on top of each other create this sort of filled canvas with lines and such. Yeah.
That's so cool. And how long did that take to create?
That one was actually pretty easy because I wasn't really trying to make the data insightful. It was just, we have data, let's make it look in a way that's mesmerizing to watch. But that one took me about 20 hours from start to finish. But that was actually pretty fast for my typical personal projects.
Okay. But that was like mind, what's it called? Mesmerizing, like just looking at it, it's like hypnotizing and maybe calming in with some people. What about the one A Breathing Earth? I think that's one of the latest ones that is featured on your website, even though like you created it last year, I think. How long did that take?
That one took, it was actually created in April this year, but it took about 80 hours to create. And that was mostly because I wanted to learn some new tools to visualize things online. I was typically using D3, but that one has like a limit on the number of objects that you can visualize. And this time I had like 50,000 circles representing the Earth throughout the year in terms of how green different patches of the Earth are. And I had to learn Pixie and WebGL and these kinds of other tools. And that took a lot of time figuring that out. That was the bulk of that. And learning how to deal with satellite data was something that was also new to me. So figuring out how to use that in R and get out the data that I needed for my visualization.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wow, that's cool. So that one was created with R?
It was, the data was prepared with R, but the visualization was eventually created with a combination of a little bit of D3 and a lot of Pixie and Regal.
Okay, that's interesting. So I know D3 is it's an online thing. Uses JavaScript in the background.
Yeah.
But what about Pixie and Regal? Are they also online, or did you have to pull them with D3?
No, they're sort of similar in that sense that they're both in the browser, so you both code them in JavaScript. But Pixie.js is sort of the idea that it makes it easier for you to work with WebGL, because WebGL is very low level. It can be quite a challenge to actually code and program in that. And Pixie.js has like these APIs that you can more easily do certain things. So it's still JavaScript, but you're really working on the GPU of your laptop or PC to actually make it visible, which means that you have much more power and can visualize much more, many more objects at the same time.
That's fantastic. I love that. Like how we just went from you're an artist and you're very creative and you just like work with butterflies to you like talking about GPUs and how technical you can get and all these things. That's so cool. So there we go. Real data science in action. So let's take a step back. So let's see how you came to this place. Like, 'cause this is a podcast about careers and how to inspire, like inspiring people to take on different journeys in the space of data science. How did you start? What did you study at university and where did you go from there?
I studied astronomy. And I really loved it. I'm still fascinated by everything astronomical and all those things. But I knew at the end of my master that I didn't want to continue on to do a PhD because I really hated writing papers. Mm-hmm. So but there's no standard way to go from astronomy into something that isn't astronomy. So I looked at a lot of things and eventually ended up at the consultancy branch of Deloitte. They were just starting up an analytics department within their business intelligence department. And that really intrigued me, the idea of still trying to dig through data to find insights, but no longer about stars and simulations about your galaxies, but about what people buy. It still intrigued me to find hidden insights. So that's how I started there. And I was working as a data scientist, but the first few months, 2 or 3 months, it was mostly learning machine learning because it was so new in the Netherlands back then that I didn't have it officially during my astronomy years. I mean, eventually I came to understand that some of the things that I was using had like a proper name. Mm-hmm. In machine learning, but I didn't know it that at the time. So I was reading through all kinds of papers, learning about support vector machines and the linear regressions and these kinds of things. And I was doing that in the next 3 or 4 years, just mostly data science. But as consultants, we were always external at our clients, which means we often had to present to back to our clients what we were finding with PowerPoints, and that often implied making some sort of visualization of our data and our findings. And then sort of slowly through that, I discovered at some point that I was spending more hours creating a good and understanding visualization than I was having fun in getting 1% extra accuracy in my predictive model. In the last year before, in my third year at Deloitte, I completely switched focus from data science to learning data visualization more and more, and becoming the expert within our department on that.
Interesting. So was it the case that others, after they did the insights, they would come for you to create the visualizations?
Well, during that final year, it was a bit of a blend. So I was still doing a lot of data science because it really depends on what the managers can sell. And I had 40 hours to fill, so I still did data science. But I was helping, giving advice to other people on how they might visualize something. And then some of the bigger visualization jobs I would take on, but I would still be involved in the data munging and the analysis at some part. In our team, we would have like a division, but I still feel that to make a really good visualization, you need to understand your data. And the best way to understand your data is have some sort of feeling with it that you might get through cleaning it analyzing it.
Okay, that's a very interesting link. And what would you say, like, you mentioned that you enjoy personally more the visualization part than the modeling, and also that it's important to do both in a way, at least to some extent, to understand the data better when you get to the visualization. What would you say is important, most important from the perspective of the client? Like, how would you rank, or from doesn't have to be the client, if you're working in an organization from the perspective of your boss or the manager or the CEO or the company even, how would you rank the modeling versus the visualization? Which one is more important or less important, and how do they go hand in hand?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, they're so dependent on each other. I have found, though, that sadly, in a way, that people could have spent 3 months on creating a fantastic algorithm that does wonderful things, but if they cannot get the output across to their audience, to our less technical clients, then that was all for nothing, because they wouldn't use it, they wouldn't implement it, it would just sort of fall by the wayside. And then you might make a simple but very effective visualization of that in just a few hours, and that could sort of switch the tides around completely, because suddenly the client could understand, oh, that's what you're doing, that's what I'm seeing, that's what it's used for. I've seen that happen, but I feel that it's a visualization needs the fundament of the data and the insights and the algorithm to create something in the first place. An algorithm can exist without a visualization, but a visualization might not exist without the data preparation or the algorithm. Mm-hmm. I think an algorithm can really benefit from a good understanding of how to visualize it.
Okay, gotcha. But at the same time, like, I would probably say that there's a limit to how much you should spend on an algorithm, right? If you spend, you know, the 80-20 rule, right? You can spend, you make an algorithm with like 90% accuracy, or you can get it to 91% accuracy and spend an extra week on it, or you can take that week and spend it on the visualization. And I think that will be more beneficial. So it's like kind of like a trade-off.
Yes, I completely agree with you.
Yeah, in terms of time. Okay, cool. So you worked at Deloitte, and I also worked at Deloitte. So it's really cool because I found out about your visualization just after I left Deloitte, about your SOMS algorithm and about your website. by the way, those who don't know, the website is visualcinnamon.com, and we'll mention the links at the end. But if somebody's like watching and on their computer want to look around, then you can find it there. And And it was so cool. Like, what was your, let's talk about Deloitte for a second. What was like the best things that you took away from Deloitte? Why did you enjoy your time in Deloitte? And if you did, then why?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I definitely enjoyed my time at Deloitte. I very much enjoyed the clients that we were working for, the different kinds of challenges that we were facing. It was always challenging in a way that we were doing something new or had to figure out our own way or dive into maybe some new algorithm that we hadn't used before but seemed interesting to use here. And I also very much enjoyed my colleagues who were just as crazy about analytics as I was, and just the fact that I also very much enjoyed the diversity of being a consultant, so that you actually see a completely different client every few weeks or every few months, and you have to become an expert in their field of working within no time. And you only have a certain number of weeks or months to do something. So you really have, you're working towards something that has, the deadline is always looming in a way, which makes you, as a team, I felt it was, you come together more quickly. Mm-hmm. The teams change every new project. I was with different people. So I really liked all of that diversity. And just the things that we were working on, it was from retail companies to fast food companies to insurance companies. It was all over the place. I guess I also enjoyed the fact that when I said I wanted to do data visualization, that they were supportive of that, and they were trying to find and sell visualization-oriented data analytics kind of projects.
Totally agree. And I also like that, like, you learn a lot, right? Through all these engagements, like, you have to go yes. through different tools, you have to go through different methodologies and explore new things that you can't even find anywhere else and come up with your own new ways. It really develops that sign of your creative thinking and ability to, like, think on your feet and get these answers quickly. And, you know, like, if it doesn't work, move on, get the next one, and then move on, and then finally found something, okay, quickly get this thing out.
Exactly.
So it was a fun time. It's like, for me, it was like going to university for the third time, but like, real life setting. So yeah, that was cool. So Deloitte, you did spent 3 years at Deloitte. And after that, four years. Okay, 4 years. Okay, that's quite a lot. I heard the maximum churn that they experienced, like Deloitte and other consulting firms, big ones, they experienced like 5 years. People usually, like, after that, they leave. So did you leave because you burnt out, or did you leave because you had other things that were interesting?
It was a combination of things. I was having a good time, but also the typical path upwards within a consultancy is the expectation that you want to become a partner. Mm-hmm. You want to rise quickly, become a manager, sell stuff. But that wasn't driving me. I wanted to have fun at my job, and I wanted to become more of a specialist, not a generalist. I wanted to help people, but I didn't want to be a people manager. I wanted to be more of a teaching others what I had learned on a technical aspect. Mm-hmm. And I definitely didn't want to do sales. So at some point I was at the level right below manager, and I was coming up to become manager, and I felt that was probably not where I wanted to go, but I also didn't want to stay in the level below manager. Yeah. In that sense that I would be earning to go up, but because I was having a good time at the place where I was, I wanted to stay there, but there was no other way to sort of show the appreciation that I find it difficult to explain, but in a way I felt like...
Like, their only way to show their appreciation for your work would to promote you, but that's like contrary to what you want. You want to stay doing the technical.
Yeah, in a way, but I didn't want to, like, people that did want to become a manager, like, pass me by in a way, even though we were both equally appreciated. But it was, you know, it was on my mind. But then I was contacted by Agen. They were looking for a data analyst, and I told them that I wasn't interested in that, but I was interested if they needed a full-time data visualization designer. Mm-hmm. And they thought about it, and they were like, yeah, actually, we could really use that as well. Mm-hmm. So then I came there, and there was a great vibe, and I was also interested, after 4 years of Deloitte, how would it be actually working at one place for a long period of time that you can really dig into that data? And this felt like a really good place to actually try that out. And after 4 years, I felt like, yeah, maybe I should move on and try something else.
Okay, fantastic. So Agen, what does this company do, Agen?
Adyen is a fintech company, financial technology. So they handle payments. So if you take a ride through Uber or buy something from the App Store or get your clothes at Nike and you pay for that, it's actually Adyen that handles the payments. So they make sure that they sort of get your data and they process it in the right way. They check for all kinds of risk and fraud settings. If like that bank's computers aren't working, they try a different kind of route to make sure that eventually it ends up at the bank and ends up at the other side at Nike or at Uber. Mm-hmm. So they process payments in that sense so that the companies who sell products or services don't have to worry about that.
Okay. So kind of like Stripe for credit cards.
It's exactly like Stripe in that sense. Yeah. Adyen does more payment methods, though, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. And so what was your role at Adyen?
Anything that had to do with data visualization. So it could be, I've made a lot of dashboards from start of trying to figure out what we need to visualize, to designing it, to testing it, to building it, to testing it some more, to making better visuals for marketing slides, to making internal tools such as an organizational chart, or we had these big screens where you could sort of see how things are going throughout the day, things for that. So it was anything where data visualization was involved, I could be helping that out or I could be leading that.
Okay, interesting. And so can you share some of the tools that you used predominantly in your work at Adyen?
Yeah. For sketching, pen and paper. I'm really a person of that starts. I always start with just plain pen and paper because it's so easy to just draw whatever you want, mm-hmm. and you don't have to be an artist for data visualization. Just squares and curves and circles. Mm-hmm. But afterwards, I would typically go to Sketch or Illustrator to make some mockups to show to other people, and then often to D3. The dashboards were built in D3 and lots of other things as well. For the marketing slides, though, it was often a combination of R combined with Illustrator for final touch-ups.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very interesting. So R and D3. So we'll get to the tools in a second. How long did you spend at Adyen? How many years?
I was there full-time for a year and then part-time for another 6 months. Mm-hmm. So a year and a half in total.
And now just recently you moved to doing your own thing, completely independent, yeah, by yourself. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
How do you feel?
I feel still super happy of being able to do this because it's exactly, again, what I was looking for. And now I can choose my own jobs that seem interesting and work with clients that I'd never dream working with, like Google, for example. It's been fantastic already.
That's so cool. And so like a lot of our listeners actually would love to be independent freelancers, just like you, maybe not in the space of just data visualization, but more inside of analytics or modeling or AI or anything. Can you tell us a bit more about that step? You know, was it a hard step to make and how did you prepare for it? You mentioned that you were part-time for 6 months and like, how did you prepare yourself on one hand, from a professional side that, you know, you will have work to do and how that client, you will have clients to work with. And on the other hand, from like an emotional side, you know, to take this leap and to go on your own.
So it's a little bit twofold in that way. So I'm very risk averse. So that's always, I've been thinking about freelancing for longer, but I always felt like I can't handle the fact that I don't have exactly that amount of, you know, on my bank statement that point in time. The first thing came when I was on vacation last November and we were approached, Shirley, who's a dear friend of me, also data viz designer. We were both approached by Google to do a project for them, but I was full-time employed. So I couldn't, but I thought, well, I just don't want to miss that opportunity to do something and work for Google. So I just decided that I'd want to try and start the freelancing thing. And what I had in mind is to do it part-time. So I talked a lot with Adyen and eventually came to a decision where I would stay on 3 days in the week with Adyen and then 2 days I would do my own thing. That would give me enough time to pick up Google for the first 3 months and then continue doing Adyen. And that would still help, you know, give some income, enough income so that I could pay my rent and get food and such, even if after Google nothing came anymore. So that was, at least for me financially, gave that enough time, because then I could sort of, in those 3 months that I was doing the thing for Google, I could also mention and promote myself as a freelancer and see if I could get next, you know, other jobs for the months afterwards. And that was actually going so well that 5 or 6 months later, I looked at the number of people. I wasn't doing like administration well enough. So I was looking at how many hours have I sold. And I saw that if I was going to do everything, I would be completely full-time full from July onwards. And I'm like, yeah, that's not possible. I only have 2 days. So and then I thought, well, I'll probably, now I should be able to handle full-time. So I quit at Agen to start full-time, because I had that sort of insurance that at least for the first 2 or 3 months after July, I would be able to fill enough time again to get enough cash flow to get that financial security feeling back.
Yep.
But on the other hand, something that also had to do with it is that when I had the sort of the stroke of lightning that I was like, oh, maybe I'm more visualization than a data scientist, I started a website where I shared all of my personal projects and tutorials, like the ones that you read on some, because I really wanted to, again, teach other people the things that I had learned, but I also wanted to share what I created to get input back, like, does this work or is it a bad visualization? And I've been doing that for the past 2 or 3 years just because I was so enthusiastic about visualization. And that has sort of helped me. I didn't know that at the start, but it has helped me sort of get a presence in the field of data visualization. And that helps me get clients now. So I didn't start it with the idea that I would become a freelancer 3 years later. But right now I'm so benefiting from the fact that I started that blog 3 years ago. So yeah. That also because I get emails, I used to get emails from now and then from people asking me if they could hire me, and I would have to say no, but now I can say yes.
Yeah, no, that's so cool. And I was just about to ask that, you know, how did Google find out about you? And probably through your blog, is that right?
Yes, both my blog and the fact that I'm doing a personal project with that friend Shirley Wu called Data Sketches. And they picked up on that as well, and that combination. Yeah.
No. So that's a very important step for those out there wondering, oh yes, if I get contacted by Google, then of course I'll become a freelancer. Well, you know, to get contacted by Google or by any other company, you need to be visible. You need to have a name for yourself out there. So, you know, if you don't have a blog, first step, start a blog. You know, have a LinkedIn, start a blog. And we've talked about this in other podcasts, so you can listen to those. But definitely having a presence and showing not only your skills, but also, as you mentioned, your passion for a certain area, even without the thought of how this is going to benefit you in the future, how you're going to monetize this. Because, like, you know, a lot of people start a blog and think, how am I going to put advertising on it, or how am I going to make money? No, you just do it because you're passionate about it. Because you want it. And I really appreciate what you said, that you wanted to share and educate. You wanted to share with the world and educate people so that they could do the same things that you're doing. And, you know, empower them. And that's very, very powerful to showcase to others. So whether you want to get a full-time job with a great company or you want to do freelancing, that's always going to tell people about your strengths and what exactly you're interested in, what you're good at. And that will always be a good case for you when you're, you know, bidding for these projects or looking for jobs. So yeah, so that's a great way of doing it. And it really worked out well for you. So that's very exciting.
Yeah.
Okay. So you did. So you've started this freelance career, and how does it feel? Does it feel different, like, or does it feel more stressful, or less stressful than working inside a company? Because, like, from my own experience, on one hand, you get the, like, illusion of freedom of time, but on the other hand, you tend to, like, get take so much on that you're like you're working so much. But and again, on the other hand, it doesn't really feel like work because you're having so much fun. How does it feel for you?
It's also a combination of things. I do try to. I read some books when I started freelancing on how many hours should I sell. And I try to stick to that. But sometimes something really amazing comes by, and like, oh, I'll take that on as well. But it's true, the fact that you sort of can choose, or at least can have a say over the projects that you take on. It's typically a more fun project than you might get if your manager tells you to do something. And I do sometimes, if I sit and think about it, I might be daunted by a big project that's coming up now that I have to lead a few people. I'm like, oh my God, so that's so much responsibility. But then I just stop thinking about that and write down my to-dos and follow them. It's no use to linger on these things, but just focus on the tasks and the fun parts. And until now, it's been going okay. I have no difficulty with picking up some hours in the evening or in the weekend. If it's sunny outside, I might take a long lunch of an hour and a half instead of just half an hour. Mm-hmm. But I picked that up at some other point. I have to admit, though, I don't have a super much experience because I've only been full-time for like a month and a few days. Yeah. But at least until now, I've been able to manage it.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. All right. So how about we talk about some like visualization? Like, obviously, you have all this experience about visualization. What are some of the, I don't know, like advice, some of the advice that you can give to our listeners on visualization? Let's start somewhere and then we'll go from there and see like what tips and hacks we can go into and things like that.
Sure. I think the most important thing seems so obvious, but it's forgotten more often than you may think, and that is to know your goal at the start. So even if you're data, you need to have a question that this data or the visualization has to answer. What should people learn when they are looking at a visualization of this data? Make sure that you have that clear. Actually write it down. I mean, you think you may know it in your mind, but if you can't make a full sentence on the paper, then you don't quite have it yet. Or maybe there's a goal. Maybe they should be convinced, or maybe they should take action. But make sure that you know what you want to get out of the visualization beforehand. And then another thing or a tip is that maybe just try to broaden your mind in that sense. There's more than just lines and pies and bars out there. There are so many different ways that you can visualize data these days. Just look up Sankey diagram, which is an amazing visualization to show flows. And there are so many more visuals. And you can't put data into a bar chart and think that that will solve everything, or a line chart, and that will show all kinds of insights. Each kind of data set combined with the question has visual forms that work better and that work less well. And it's good if you just take some time to think about if your visual form that you have in mind is actually going to show the insights or answer the question that you have in mind. So don't just put it into the standard options that your tool gives them, but try and see what the broad scope of options is and think about all of them and see and choose which one of those will work best in that sense. And the rest is more on the design front. And that's the typical things that, you know, try never to use pie charts. Don't make the non-data parts stand out. I mean, no black axes, you know, very dimmed down grid lines, these kinds of things. Make the data stand out. Use annotations. If something is interesting about the data, you know, call it out. Make like a circle and say like, oh my God, look what's happening here. And don't have a title that says X versus Y, but say the conclusion, you know, the stock prices has been going up until blah, blah happened. And, you know, that way, don't underestimate the use of text in that to help people understand the visualization.
Okay. Those some great tips. So just to recap, have the question or the goal ready, broaden your mind, so use other diagrams, like check out the Sankey diagram, for instance, and then design some design tips, avoid pie charts, dim the axes, add annotations. What would you say about colors? Like, I've noticed you use lots of different combinations of colors depending on the visualization and the mood you want to convey. Would you say colors are important, and how do you pick colors for your visualizations?
Yeah, colors in data visualization are very important because often they can actually convey data as well. Because for categories, if you want to distinguish different categories, different countries, it's best to give them different colors. Or if you want to say something goes from low to high, you can say that's like light blue to dark blue. So there are many ways that you can make it, because people can see that easily. They can interpret that easily in by using colors that something is like light is low and darker is higher or more. But they also have a lot of challenges because you might have, you know, 220 countries and we can't distinguish 220 different colors. That's more like 8 different colors is typically the absolute max that you can have in different colors. So there are always these challenges with colors as well, even though they are very powerful. And they can also help the mood, indeed, should it be playful or more subdued. Mm-hmm. Or the data itself for this visualization I made about Earth, green, of course, made perfectly sense.
Yeah.
Whereas for a visualization I made about translations and words, it felt more like a gray books kind of scheme might work. And other times it could be more in a tasteful rainbow kind of scheme.
rainbow.
Yeah.
Okay. So color is quite important. We've talked about some design elements. What are some of your favorite visualization, like charts or types of visualizations?
Oh, that's difficult. I especially like the visualizations where the chart is in a way unique, where the chart has been custom built to show that particular data set.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I have a lot of Pinterest boards where I save all of my favorite visualizations. Ooh, that I often refer so cool. to.
Can you, are you going to be able to share them at the end of the podcast?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, cool.
I mean, anybody can see them. There's one called Poppy Fields. Mm-hmm. I don't quite know how it's a visualization about all of the conflicts that have happened across the earth over the past 100-ish years. When it started, when it ended, how long it lasted, the number of people that were that perished, in which kind of state of the earth, continent it took place. And it looks like a field of poppies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very visually appealing, and there is so much information that you can gather from it by actually looking at it for an extended amount of time. But it's also easy to interpret. Wonderful combination of many levels of layers of detail combined with intuitive visualization that's always mm-hmm. difficult.
Okay, so this is actually the next thing I wanted to ask you, that how do you go about the trade-off between having too much, like having a lot of information, but then too much on your visualization versus having a more like a smaller visualization or like a more like a nice looking visualization, but less information on it. How do you go about that?
Oh, I always find that one difficult. I don't have a formula for that though. It has to do with looking at each case and deciding if adding an extra layer of detail would really add to the stories that people would be able to find, or if it's just an extra level, but it can't really be connected to any of the other variables that are already present. So it wouldn't be like a 1 + 1 = 3 kind of thing, but it was just like, yeah, it's just something extra, but it sort of stands alone. So if it really lets people see the complexity of the underlying data more, then I am all for including that. But it is also thinking about how busy is my visualization already, and I think I can add something more. And that's really just a personal choice that I make, and then try and ask other people mm-hmm. if that is working or not, and if I should take it out.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I succeed, and also sometimes I fail and it doesn't work and it's too much. And people are like, I have no idea what I'm supposed to get from this.
Okay. So you do ask other people's opinions before you deliver the final result.
Yeah, I often share the final results secretly with some people, and they give me some feedback, and I incorporate that if I can before I share it out in the world. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's important. And when I was creating the course on R programming, I encountered ggplot2 and the grammar of graphics, and actually mm-hmm. studied the grammar of graphics quite a bit, and was very fascinated by the layered approach, and that you have the data, then you have some like geometries, you have some aesthetics and so on. What is your thought on that? Like, do you like follow that type of grammar of graphics approach, or do you have some other view on how to create your visualizations?
I really use ggplot a lot, and I quite enjoy it, although I have to admit I had never read the grammar of graphics. I know what it's about, but I like parts of it, but still I feel that for the sort of more creative approach that I try to take. I am not too constrained by it.
Yeah.
I feel that it has a good set of things to handle if maybe you like it's something. If otherwise you don't have your own thing, then it's a good way to follow. But if you at some point you want to break out, you know the rules so you know when to break them in
yeah.
a way.
Yeah, yeah.
That's sort of how I feel with those ways. It's a good handhold, but I'm not. I don't want to be constrained by it.
Yeah, totally. And just to be clear, I haven't read Camera Room Graphics either. I've just like you just studied little bits and pieces. But yeah. So okay, I think so as well that for certain applications like. More kind of like standardized approaches, it can be useful, but for more of the creative stuff that you do, maybe there's other ways. Okay, so how about we talk a little bit about the tools now? So we've mentioned a couple, we've talked about D3, and I've actually, when I was at Deloitte, funny enough, I played around with D3. We even had like a little competition inside our data analytics division on like creating D3 visuals, which is really cool. So you mentioned D3 and R. Before we move into those, have you ever used Tableau?
Yes, I've used Tableau and I've used ClickView as well.
Okay, what do you think of Tableau and ClickView? Are those like D3 and R kind of like more advanced ways to get into visualization as I can imagine? Like, do you think Tableau is a good visualization tool?
I think it is a good visualization tool. I have to admit, I don't use them anymore, but I can explain why. But I feel that especially for exploratory visualizations, Tableau works really well because it's so easy to just drag things to everywhere and get different views of the data. The reason why I'm not using it anymore is because your options are limited. I mean, I've seen people hack wonderful things together, but in essence, you have a collection of X visualizations that you can use. And I typically want something that is slightly different or completely different from the default. And to make those, even the small adjustments in Tableau or especially ClickView can be quite a chore. And that's what eventually drove me to D3, which is very low level, but it gives you... You're more constrained by your imagination and the browsers themselves than the tool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and your blog is a testament to that. Like when people check out Visual Cinnamon, they'll see that you know you've created some incredible things. Like I wouldn't even imagine that you could have something like that in a browser, like just like working. it's crazy. Like I think you need a separate. It sometimes feels like it's drawn on a paper, but then it starts moving, and you're like, "Whoa!" It's like it's actually it's really cool. So, D3. What is D3? Why is it why is it a visualization tool? Why is it popular?
So D3 is a JavaScript library. It works in the browser together with HTML and CSS. And it's a way to bind data to your elements on the screen. And it's typically SVGs, scalable vector graphics, mm-hmm. which is typically if you make something in Adobe Illustrator, you make some things in vectors.
Yeah.
That if you make them 15 times as big, they're still perfectly sharp. Not pixelated. And that's the same way with SVGs. So you don't draw them. It's more that you create shapes that are, if you were to look under the hood, you would see paths and more things that look like math than anything that looks like an image. But anyway, D3 is a way to bind data to these elements. So I could say that I want to create 10 rectangles because my data is 10 elements long. And I want to have the width of my rectangles depend on the data that is bound to them. So the first rectangle will get the data of the first row, and the second rectangle will get the data of the second row, and so on. So it's really, that is what D3 in its base does. But it has a lot of extra things to make scaling easy, to make colors, or lots of other things that are built around it that make it easier to sort of handle and draw these shapes eventually. But it's a low level, so you have to build up your own axes. You have to place the points on the screen and all these things. So it's all these separate handles, and I feel it's like Lego. You just have all of these separate things and you pick what you need and make your own visualization. And then if you want to, you can take things completely outside of D3, but it is JavaScript, and then put it on there as well if that gives the result that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
That's in a way that you can be creative with the visualization.
That's really cool. And how long would you say it would take somebody to pick up D3 on the very basic level?
So personally, when I first saw D3, I had like my last HTML CSS experience was 10 years before that when I made my own Neopets site. So that's been mostly a way that was gone. And it took me about a week of, you know, twiddling about and everything before I had my first interactive scatter plot where stuff happened if you moused over a circle, because I had to learn JavaScript and sort of relearn HTML and CSS. Yeah. And after that, it still took me about a year of on and off, sometimes doing something with D3 in my free time before I got to the point where I could use it during my job as well, which then sort of accelerated afterwards, and I could do it more on my job, learn more, do more advanced stuff at my job, learn even more, and so on. I wouldn't say it's a steep curve, but for me, it was definitely worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really cool. And like, I can attest to that, like when I was learning D3, I also just for fun, it was, took me like, I think 2 weeks before I had like quite an interesting visualization of like, I know you said don't use pie charts, but it had pie charts in it. and it was clickable, and it was like a visualization of what I did was like took everybody in our department at Deloitte and visualized what projects they worked on and what their skills are, and you could click or come up with information. And like what I can say about D3 is that it's, first of all, it's very inspiring when you see all these visualizations. Like look at Nadi's visualizations or Mike Bostock, yeah, at Blocks, MB Blocks or something like that, .org or something like that.
Yeah,
he's got some fantastic visualizations. I think he was originally the person that wrote D3 or like, I don't know, he worked with them. And so they're very inspiring, and also at the same time very logical. It looks complicated that it's HTML and it's JavaScript, but it's actually just like, it's like coding, and then inside like the code is nested inside itself, like new elements of code are nested within them, because like if you have a like a visual element and then you have another visual element inside it, then that would be nested inside the code. So it's very logical, very easy to pick up if you're like logically minded. And yeah, and that makes it very fast, like in my view, very fast to learn. And of course, to get to some very cool visualizations, very creative visualizations like Nadi is doing, you need some time and you need a lot of practice. But to get to some very basic ones with some pie charts, scatter plots and so on, just like a couple of weeks of dabbling around in D3 can get you there.
Oh, that is definitely true. And yeah, you said the blocks is D3's version of CodePen. So that's bl.ocks.org. Mm-hmm. But there's also blockbuilder.org where you can sort of code within the browser, which is really interesting. But yeah, it's quite easy to just pick an example from somebody else, put in your own data and try and figure out how to make it work with your data and then make some adjustments to that. True.
Yeah, that's right. And then you find this little one thing where the color goes transparent and you're like, what is going on? Like I've had this so many times. One part of the visualization for some reason is just like not working like everything else. You're like, oh, where did I find it? And it's just like, it's different to like an algorithm because you can actually see when something's wrong, you can see. If everything's right, then everything will look right. But so it's good in a way, but it's also so frustrating when you can't find that little one problem in your code. It takes
eight. Yeah, I've had so many times where at some point I was convinced my computer was being irrational and it wasn't me.
Yeah,
of course it was somewhere in my code.
Yeah, it's always the case. Okay, and so thank you for that overview of D3. I think that's powerful. And what I wanted to talk about now was you're also a speaker. You also go to, you've been on, this is your fifth podcast or you know, sixth or something like that. And not only podcasts, you go to conferences and you speak at conferences. So tell us a bit more about that, because that ties in with, I've seen one of your speeches on YouTube, which where you go back from like, you know, how you studied astronomy and then you go into visualization. And I think you combine the two, astronomy and visualization, in that presentation. But just about presentation, it ties in with visualization, because once you have the visualization, you need to present it. What would you say about that? Like how do you prepare your visualizations in a way that when you're actually presenting them to a client, that not only they can make sense on their own, but that you can add value through speaking about the presentation and about the visualization, actually being there and talking about it?
I feel that I do typically, if I create something with for a client, I do try to create something where they wouldn't need me to have to look at it or use it or get insights from it. So typically, if I do the design part of a visualization for a client, I have the screenshots of all my designs and the inspiration that led me to those designs, and I really talk through it like a PowerPoint slide in that sense. But if I have a final and then we talk about the different designs and what might work and which won't work and where do we want to actually build some of these out into an actual working database. But if for a final data visualization, I've often had touch points with the client before the final part, because you want to make sure that they're still happy with it, the way it's going halfway as well. You know, is this going in the right direction? So it's not the first time they've seen it, and they sort of know how to understand it as well. So the final point where I'm presenting it back, like face to face to the client, is typically more of a official thing, but not unofficially. It's not the most important part of it in a way, because of these touch points throughout the weeks leading up to that. But in my presentations that I do for conferences, it's slightly different, because then the people haven't seen it before. And there, what I do is I make my presentations in Reveal.js. So yeah. My presentations are a collection of websites, HTMLs, and that makes me actually incorporate the interactive visualization on a slide in a way. So if I am, it's because a lot of my visualizations are interactive and I can make screenshots of that, but that doesn't, I can make movies of that, but it's not the same as actually interacting with it while I'm speaking about it. So during a presentation, I will make sure that I have access to the interactive visualization, or I make stuff happen. So I can make steps happen that if I click on the next, some part of visualization might change or highlight certain parts that I'm speaking about at that point, or have an animation running so that what I'm talking about is what people are seeing happening on the screen. And so for the final portions, it takes a lot of time to build my visualization. Build my presentations. Typically, 40 minutes of presentation takes me about a month and a half of evenings and weekends to code out. but it's been worth it in the end, because it's seeing that it works a lot better than just PowerPoint slides with screenshots and movies, to have these fully functioning visuals that do stuff during a presentation.
Wow, that's really cool, and yeah, that would be very interesting to see one of your presentations. And like I think there's a few on floating around online. And I'd like to touch on what you mentioned for the corporate presentations. That is a very good technique when you don't, sometimes I like to leave it as a surprise, and then, you know, at the very end show the client, and then you're like, oh, and they hate it or something's wrong. So it's a very good technique to actually work with them and show them the intermediate steps and work with them about the designs and get the confirmation throughout the way. So when the final day comes, you present and it's actually something that they've actually been working towards. So if they don't like it, then they're kind of saying that they don't like what they've been working on, and they're not going to say that, right? They're going to obviously like it. So it's a great way. So thanks for sharing that, and kind of like wrapping up our podcast, because it's been a very quick hour. I just don't know where it flew. What is your some final tips for those looking to get into the space of data science and be like you, do what you do?
I feel that, and I'm sure I am definitely not the first person to say this, but I feel like the best way is to be driven by a passion, but also to do a lot. So the best way to learn is to either make your own or apply your own algorithms or create your own visualizations. And every time you do that, you learn something new that you can take on to your next project and then get it more and more advanced. But also share your enthusiasm to people, and so that they notice that. They notice what, you know, even if you can do something very well, but you don't like it, don't mention it. Try not to mention it so that people don't actually know that they can use you for that. I used to be able to do SaaS, but I hated it, so I never mentioned it to anyone. So in that sense, people knew where to find me for the things that I was promoting myself for. but you need to be able to do it. So it might take more time. You probably, if you really want to get to it, you might have to put in more time that you can do at your work, and you have to do personal projects as well to get into the at the front of data science, to work with those algorithms that you might not be able to work with at work. You need to get a handle on it with personal projects in that sense. So that would be my advice.
Thanks for sharing. So guys, like, let your passion drive you and show what you want to work on, and don't be afraid to spend your personal time on, you know, the things that you love to get even better. So thanks a lot for coming on the show, Nadine. Is there, like, what's the best way for our listeners to contact you and follow your career and see some of your amazing visualizations?
I'm very active on Twitter. That's just my first and last name together, Nadi Bremer. And because the database scene really lives on Twitter. So if you want to know what people are working on, working progress or final results, you can follow me there. And I have like a website, visualcinnamon.com, again, because I don't expect people to spell my name correctly. So I thought at least my website should be like an easy name. And that's where I share all of my finished projects and all of my blogs and tutorials and the new presentations. Mm-hmm. And I'm scattered around the web, but those two are definitely the most important ones.
Okay. Are you active on LinkedIn?
Yes.
Okay.
That's and Bremer. I'm also on Twitter with Nadi Bremer, and also Instagram with Nadi Bremer.
Okay. So. Gotcha. Okay. So we'll share all those in the show notes, definitely. And one last question for you. What's a book that you can recommend to our listeners to help them become better at data science, visualization, and just their
Let me grab it.
Yeah.
I have a whole book collection of database books. But I think anybody starting should start with this book, The Functional Art by Alberto Cairo. Mm-hmm. I like it a lot. It's one of the first books I read as well because it is so diverse. It looks at both the psychology behind seeing, which I find super fascinating, to, again, figuring out this question that you need to have and how that can affect your eventual visual state. He shows a few horrible ones that he turns into good ones by looking at it in different ways. He has been a graphics editor at several newspapers, so he shows a lot of results. And finally, he has interviews with people in the field that I admire a lot, so it's very interesting to read about how they, each of them, in their own ways, handles the visualization of data. So I really like it because it's very introductory, but also very diverse and complete in that way.
Fantastic. Thank you a lot for sharing that. The Functional Art by Alberto Cairo.
Yeah.
So there you go, guys. That was Nadi Bremer. Make sure to follow her on Twitter. We'll include the links in the show notes. And once again, thank you so much, Nadi, for coming on the show.
No problem. Thank you again for having me.
So there we go. Thanks, guys, for listening to this podcast. So excited to have shared Nadisa's story with you. I hope you enjoyed the insights that she shared. And personally, my favorite was just the general sentiment, just general energy that Nadi conveys about her work, about visualization, how excited she is. And if you were watching the video version of this podcast, you would see that, you know, how her eyes light up when she's talking about data visualization and some aspects of her work. So it's very inspiring, very encouraging to see people who are so passionate about what they do. And of course, Nadi's whole story is very inspiring, how she didn't give up on her passion, how she decided what is her passion, what she's good at, what she wants to do. And even when a job opportunity came along for a data analyst, as she said that she would prefer to be a data visualization designer, and she created that job opportunity for herself. So that's a story to get inspired by. And of course, reach out to Nadi, follow her on Twitter, make sure to find her and follow all of her new updated visualizations. Of course, also check out visualcinnamon.com. There's some amazing, fantastic visualizations there. And you can get all of the links to Nadi's profiles on LinkedIn, Twitter, and her website and more at www.superdatascience.com/81. There you can also get the show notes and the video for this episode. And if you enjoyed this podcast, we'd really appreciate if you could leave a rating or review on iTunes. It would really help us spread the word into the world and get more people inspired about data science. And on that note, I look forward to seeing you next time. And until then, happy analyzing.